The game to be played tonight is for the highest stakes of all. A man is going to wager his life. Climax presents Casino Royale from the bestseller by Ian Fleming.
Good morning, good evening, and good afternoon. Welcome to the James Bond Complex, the podcast for myself, Edgar, and
Matthew.
We review the Ian Fleming stories and compare them with the cinematic James Bond. This is, I guess, official episode number one.
This is our first discussion of the novels. Maybe it is our first episode. The other is an introduction, so it's a pre-episode, I guess.
It's like a prequel.
Yeah, it's a prequel. It's the episode one. Excuse
me! It sort of sounds like episode one,
yes,
by the way. So we're going in the sequential order of Ian Fleming's books, as opposed to the films. Therefore, unsurprisingly, episode one is Casino Royale, circa 1953.
Is it 1953? According to some sources online, it's 1951.
Really?
That's what I read.
You've been doing more reading than me, which will probably come across throughout this episode. I read the book for a few times already, and I reread it for this episode, but I had a feeling headed into this afternoon's recording session you were coming a little bit better equipped with the history behind the book. I know a little bit of the history, and I did some reading, but you came with about 15 pages worth of excerpts and notes on those excerpts. I don't have any of that stuff. I'm like, I know the book. I'll just talk about it.
I know the book, too. I reread it. I've listened to an audio recording of it. Yeah, I took notes, and I search online. They discuss a few dates. They discuss a particular event in 1946 where France made prostitution illegal, which wasn't the case.
But that background information in the book.
In the book.
It's sort of current, but it's happened a few years ago. Well, actually, we don't know. A few months ago, a few years ago.
I think there's another mention of another date of 1950. Some of the research I've found online, it could be 1951.
Interesting. I went by the publication date, but you could very well be right. I guess, shall we talk about the plot a little bit?
I guess we should.
So what happens in Casino Royale? Oh, tell me. I don't know.
Well, it looks like you're as lucky as they say.
Eh?
Oh, you're a legend, old boy. Card Sense Jimmy Bond, they call you. I knew you right away.
Aspiring paymaster Lashif has made some bad investment and lost most of his Russian employer's funds. Desperate to recoup his lost capital, he heads to Casino Royale, where he hopes to make his money back by gambling at the baccarat table. To oppose him, M, the head of the British Secret Service, has ordered James Bond, Secret Agent 007, to face off against Lashif. The agent's objective is simple: beat and bankrupt Lashif, thus ensuring his destruction and the humiliation of Smersh, the Russian espionage organization that employs him. After multiple assassination attempts and losing at the baccarat table only to have his losses covered by CIA agent Felix Leiter, Bond finally wins and bankrupts the Russian agent. Now desperate, Lashif baits 007 to a trap by kidnapping the secret agent's assistant, Vesper Lynn. Captured, tortured, and nearly dead, the secret agent's life is only saved by the arrival of a Smersh operative who murders Lashif and his cronies, but leaves James and Vesper alive. Seemingly chained by the ordeal, Bond confides in René Mathis, his French contact during the casino job, that he's considering giving up his life as a secret agent. After recuperating for a few weeks and enjoying a brief passionate affair with Vesper, the agent's happy ending is taken from him when Lynn kills herself, leaving only a confession letter. She was a double agent, working for the enemy. Now alone, angry and grief-stricken, Bond swears vengeance upon Smersh. And thus ends Casino Royale, 1953.
Be fair, Mr. Bond. It's all in the game. We're both gamblers. And I've lost.
Essentially, I think one of the terms that we'll be using, I'm sure, in this episode and for the next few books is Smersh.
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 Smersh spion.
That's just great. You know, say it with the Sean Connery. Smersh.
Smersh spion.
It is.
Which is a fanciful Russian term for death to spies. They're not really an espionage branch of the Soviet Union. They're more an assassination. But not even foreign agents, they kill their own. That's basically their raison d'être, that they kill people they can no longer trust from their own units. It's my understanding, having read the book, that this Le Chiffre, he needs money. He's done some bad investments. We'll get into that. And so they say, let's get rid of this guy. So he needs to make up his deficits in order to not be assassinated by Smersh. Whilst Bond and some friends, among them one René Mathis of the Deuxième Bureau, which is like the French...
Yeah, French CIA.
It's French CIA and the CIA. Good old Felix Leiter from Texas, although he's not good old Felix Leiter. We meet him for the first time here. And someone from the... not the Treasury. I think Vesper Lynn's the Treasury in the film, but she's sort of some... She's a liaison. She's from Station S.
Yes, she's a liaison. She's...
I can't remember what the Station S is in the book. But she's from Station S. So that's her boss in the book. Just before we hit record, we actually talked about a little bit the background to the story. And there is a chapter in the book that lays out Le Chiffre's background. And among the enterprises he invested in was...
Brothels.
Brothels. They were recently made, at the time of the book, obviously.
Yeah.
They were recently made illegal in France. And
He buys a brothel in January of 1946. Couple months later, in April of 1946, the French passed La Loi Marthe Brichard on April 13, 1946, and it made prostitution illegal, and they closed all the brothels. So he made the worst investment at the worst possible time.
Good at predicting numbers, but not that good at predicting what politics will... the hammer of politics and bureaucracy and social mores.
I don't think he's that smart. He's not named Le Chiffre because he's good at math. He's named Le Chiffre because he infiltrated Europe after the war, pretending to be an amnesiac. He got his name Le Chiffre because he's just a number as a passport, so he's Le Chiffre. He's a number, so that's how he gets a number. He's not good at math.
They gave him that for the film. I think they probably wanted to make him a little bit more contemporary and cool.
Yeah.
For a villain, cool in the film. Whereas, in the book, certainly Fleming's description of him, the red hair and like the little black eyes. This is something Fleming does a lot when describing his villains. He makes them... kind of disgusting. He kind of makes them repulsive. They're often like they're human monsters in a way.
Yes.
They sweat a lot and they're not like good looking and their skin looks weird. And, he sort of lays it on very thick. He'll describe even weirder villains as we go along in the novels, but he does start that a little bit here with Casino Royale and Le Chiffre.
Allegedly, one of the inspirations, it's Anton Crawley. So I don't know if you know anything about him.
Please enlighten us.
Crawley, he had a cult, black magic, in the early part of the 20th century. And he was a really shady guy. He inspired other fictional characters. In Ghostbusters, they talk about a bunch of people doing ceremony on atop skyscrapers to bring the end of the world. That's actually a reference to Crawley. Yeah.
Nice.
And he wasn't alone. He had close to 1,000 followers when he died. They conducted rituals up on the roof. Bizarre rituals intended to bring about the end of the world, and now it looks like it may actually happen.
The more you know.
Yeah,
so,
and knowing's half the battle.
It's allegedly the inspiration for Le Chiffre. Most of the pictures I've seen of him, he looks very scary.
He doesn't look like Orson Welles, does he?
A little bit, but...
Really?
Well, he's fat, so...
Well, yeah.
Late
period Orson Welles.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let me try and find a picture.
And you were saying black magic, and Orson Welles was a bit of a magician himself. Yeah, it all makes sense now. I see what Fleming was doing. Very well played, sir.
So if you want to, I'm showing you the small part.
Yeah, I'm trying to look on. Wow, yeah, that is...
That's a scary dude.
Yeah, that is one ugly mother effer there, right there. That
like
is
those are him younger, apparently, but and some of them, but that's the picture I've seen often is him... bald.
There's a little bit of cinematic Blofeld in that face, too. Yeah, we've talked a lot about our villain. We haven't talked about our hero.
This is
a James Bond book. It's called a James Bond book. So, interesting character in this first book. Would you say he has an arc? Because usually a story has plot. Bond did A, B, C, D, and then Z happened. And a story has theme, it has arc, it has emotions. For the number of times I've read this book, maybe there's an... I'm still undecided. Does James Bond have a character?
A lot of this book for characters, it's undefined. I think Bond is probably the most defined, though. And he has an arc. What happens to him in this book probably sets him for the rest of his novel life. It's his mission. His personal mission is...
His philosophy, his outlook on life and women in particular, given how Casino Royale, the book, ends. That certainly influences him as he goes along. Because the books, there is a little bit of bondage between the stories and the book. They are interlinked a little bit. Certainly a little bit more than the movies, although some of the movies are interlinked. The books, you do get a sense that, you know, Casino Royale happens, then Live and Let Die, and then Moonraker, and so on and so forth. So yeah, I guess I would agree in the sense that the way he thinks of women and of his enemies is influenced to a degree in Casino Royale. I guess I was asking the question more because it's funny, you know, Fleming's description of him character-wise, personality-wise, you know, he certainly doesn't seem to smile or laugh a whole lot. Maybe he chuckles once or twice after he's won the card game and he's eating with Vesper Lynd. But by and large, he makes it very clear that a person in his position has the privilege of ordering very particular foods and drinks and clothing and cigarettes, and he indulges in that, which I suppose is a personality trait. He's very serious about the mission, which, again, I suppose is a character trait, but at the same time, it's also not that much of a character trait. Okay, so he takes the job seriously. Fair enough. Again, I like James Bond in the book. He's interesting. I think it's one of those cases where as the book goes along, I'm intrigued about who he is, just because I feel like we never get that. We get just enough to know kind of who he is. But by the time the book ends, I'm not like, oh, yes, I can describe James Bond. Like, I can paint a picture of who James Bond is and all his emotions. Like, not really.
No, not really. But he goes through an evolution. He starts the book and he just wants to do his mission. He wants to be done with it. He has no intention of killing anyone. He just wants to beat the Le Chiffre and be done with it. And eventually maybe get the girl. That's his main motivation. He does that. But I think what defines James Bond is everything that happens after, when he loses. I think he loses and the villain actually is a bigger threat than he assumed initially. And he's not prepared for that. And even after that, we'll spoil the goddamn thing.
Oh, for sure.
He gets his balls smashed to it.
He gets his thunderballs rocked.
He gets his thunderballs rocked. After he's been through the torture and he's recuperating, he's second-guessing himself and saying, oh, maybe I shouldn't be doing that. And it's only when Vesper is exposed as a villain, as a traitor, that he goes, no, screw this, I'm all in. Like, he reinvests himself into his career as a spy, because for a while it looks like he's going to quit. He's not going to be a secret agent anymore. And it's not only being tortured, but also having his heart broken, and a little bit he's humbled by the experience at the end of the book.
Probably. You know, actually, you know, I do agree. So I guess his arc is almost like a reaffirmation.
Exactly.
He believes in the mission at the start, then a certain portion of the mission has him question those beliefs, and then the very end, it's a reaffirmation of those same beliefs, which sets him on through the 12 or 13 adventures that in the books, the Fleming books anyways, that come after. That's actually a very well played, sir. Well played. You've convinced me now. And again, it's not like I didn't like, I wouldn't have read it five times if I didn't like the book. But I never really got a very clear picture of who he was as a guy, except the fact that he likes hot women. He's very particular about his food and drinks.
He smokes 70 cigarettes per day. 70 cigarettes is insane, in my personal opinion.
Medically speaking, it's insane as well. Biologically speaking, it's insane. And he's supposed to be fit. Actually, I think, no, in fairness, I think we kind of learn this more in later books, but he's supposed to be incredibly fit.
Yeah. That's impossible.
He eats like, I almost want to talk about Live and Let Die, because I feel that's the book where he really starts chowing down. But he eats some really interesting things in this book, and he eats a lot. You know, we're talking about like 15 course meals here, and then, you know, crème brûlée and what, and cognac for dessert. Like, it's a lot of alcohol. It's a lot of nicotine. It's a lot of fatty foods. It's a lot of meats.
And the drinking.
Oh, it's constantly drinking. Constantly.
There's a reason why Fleming didn't live to see his 60s.
Yeah. No kidding. He was 50, 54, 55, I think. 54, 55 when he passed away, which is very, I mean, even for 1960s standards, that's kind of young. It's been said many times before, there's a lot of Ian Fleming in James Bond. Yeah. A lot of what James Bond wears, eats, drinks, thinks is a lot of what Ian Fleming
yeah, it's
ate,
his alter
drank,
ego.
Wore and thought, including his love for Jamaica, which doesn't appear in...
It does.
It's mentioned. It's mentioned. Yeah. His front is a businessman from Jamaica,
yes.
I think. Yes. Yeah.
Jamaican millionaire.
Yes. And I think he actually alludes to the fact that he likes Jamaica. So, oh, that'll be an easy cover. I've been there before and
yes.
I like it, you know.
Yes.
There's already a little bit of Fleming
in
there.
He does.
A little bit of Jamaica in there. So you know, we got a lot of other characters in this book. In fact, some very important characters.
Yes.
You know, I'm thinking of some of the supporting players like Felix Leiter, who's a CIA agent from Texas, and René Mathis, who's from the Deuxième Bureau, which is the as you said, the CIA, the French version of the CIA. There is also a few other characters, namely Vesper Lynd.
Vesper Lynd, who
breaks his heart.
I have lukewarm feelings towards her. Each time I read the book, I'm like, she's an amorphous blob of a character. She's I can't.
Welcome to the world of Ian Fleming.
But she's meant to be this great love. In the other novels, it's mentioned that he visits her tomb every year around the time of her death, and I don't get it.
I think we're going to be on agreement in that she's obviously described, you know, as being rather voluptuous and a particularly very physically attractive woman, and certainly some versions of the novel where they draw her on the cover, she usually looks very sexiful. But certainly character-wise, she seems to be obviously maybe a little bit out of her league. She seems to be very impressed when Bond
yes.
is ordering all these foods, so... Already, she's sort of a little bit out of her league. You know, she's like the little girl who's joining the old boys' club. So there's a little bit of that tone, I feel, as the book goes along. Or I didn't think we get a sufficient sense of James Bond. I think that's even less the case. Or if we don't get a sense, it's even more the case with Vesper Lynd. Yeah, like, why would he fall in love with her? There's a little passage, I believe it's as he's recuperating, your favorite part of the book.
Said no one ever?
Yeah. And she, you know, she's at his bedside, and, you know, I feel terrible. I've been on the beach, and you're here, you know, nursing your cojones. There's a little passage saying, like all hard men, Bond was prone to softness when women are behaving like that. So that's sort of like a weak version to fall in love with someone. They've known each other for, because the baccarat game is in June,
mm-hmm.
and she commits suicide in late July, mid July.
Yep, that fits with the timeline you have.
And he's out for a coma for a few days.
Yeah,
during
well, he's
that
in
time.
And out. He's just. I think they keep him under for a while because it's hours that they smash his testicles. The other version where it's 15 minutes maybe. And
15 minutes is already about.
Oh, I know, but the way they describe it, it's a memorable part of the book.
Absolutely. And I think that section of the book, not only is it horrifyingly visceral just for what is happening, but also for how it's being described, and which is one of Ian Fleming's tremendous strength for all his weaknesses, because you know whatever, he's sort of an old British white dude with 1950s a view of the world. He was still damn good at certain things, and that was describing
yes.
things.
The way that it describes violence is
it's impeccable.
It's sometimes it's beautiful.
It's brilliant.
It's
horrifying. It gives you nightmares.
Yeah.
Just the contortions, and there's a passage where he says Bond's face, like. He makes the face of someone that's screaming, but there's no sound coming out because I think it's the first time his thunderballs are caressed by the carpet beater.
The carpet beater. I printed out a picture just to because
yes.
I didn't know what it was. Cause it
I like the little. I like the little caption. Ouch! Is that your touch?
Yes.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well played, sir, my dear boy. That's another thing I like. Again, I know we thought we maybe close the conversation on Le Chiffre, but I do like Le Chiffre's behavior. And that's it. My dear boy, my dear friend, I don't understand these torture methods. It's the simplest thing. Just, you know, I'm going to destroy your balls. And, you know, so I like the my dear boy, the game, the time for playing Red Indians is over. You know, you're now in the adult world. We're going to take things a little bit more seriously now. You know,
there's a line. I think I wrote it down. There will be no relenting. There is no one to stage a last minute rescue. And there is no possibility of escape for you. This is not a romantic story where the villain is finally rotted out and the hero is given the medal and marries the girl. Unfortunately, these things don't happen in real life.
And it's funny because all that he describes actually don't happen in the book.
Precisely. No, it's a really, really, it's a very dark passage of the book. It's certainly very visceral. The description of the room, they're actually at Lechiffre's villa, mm-hmm. I believe. And it's this very oddly pink wall room. And it's early in the morning and there are light shafts of early morning light coming in. So it's just a very eerie. It's very different from what they do in the film, which we'll get to in the next episode, but I like it. I do like that. But it's nightmarish. I don't like it enough to like it, but it's a really intense, enjoyable read.
It's memorable.
What about we're sort of getting ahead here. What about the Baccarat game itself, which doesn't, you know, we'll get to the movie version of Hold'em Texas Poker, but it's not as long. It's over kind of quickly. It doesn't take too much time.
He loses, then he wins. Basically, from what I gathered, what I understood, it's pretty much blackjack, but different, but the same. And there's no real strategy to it, so he just wins. Personal taste, I prefer poker. There's a little bit more strategy and thinking and described in a way that you feel, okay, you picture the other players, and it's very memorable in this way. But the game itself,
See, for the number of times I've watched Casino Royale, the film, I still don't fully understand poker.
Really? I'll need to teach you.
It's a game I have told myself more than once that I should probably learn to play because everybody seems to like it. You know, Baccarat, it's not terribly difficult. I sort of understand what they're doing. The end game is not that difficult. Try to get a nine or as close as possible, and you got two cards to do it. You know, so you know in that sense, it's not terribly difficult. But at the same time, it's maybe not as exciting as poker, where sort of the possibilities as to the hand, because if there's a greater number of cards in your quote hand, you know, the possibilities of the types of hands you can play are obviously much much greater. I would assume in poker, whereas Baccarat, it's basically you got two cards and. Try to get a nine and what is it, like a nine and a four that adds to 14, so it's actually a four. So yeah, it's you know, it's I get it. I have to assume that's maybe one of the many popular games of the period was, which is probably what was chosen. Do we not see Baccarat and Dr. No at the start of the film? Isn't that what they're playing?
I think it's Chemin de Fer.
Chemin de Fer. I agree. It's not terribly exciting. Like, I enjoy it enough. When it's over, which is like after 20 pages once it starts, I'm not like shedding any tears because, oh man, I wanted more Baccarat. No, I'm good. It's fine. We can go to the...
Nobody ever said, oh, I want more Baccarat.
And no one ever said that in the history of the world. But what about guys like Ronnie Mathis and Felix Leiter, who show up a little bit in this book? We sort of get it. We get a little bit of a sense from them. They both seem to be... Certainly Felix Leiter seems to be a bit of... would I describe him as not a happy-go-lucky kind of a guy, but he seems to be kind of positive-minded. He seems to be like a cool guy.
He seems, it's hard for me not to picture Jack Lord. And all I did was picture Jack Lord with sunglasses.
Yes. One of the great.
No, the best.
That'll be a bonus episode, listeners. Yeah, no, Felix Leiter is cool. He's not there as much as René Mathis, but he's there enough to get a sense that, he's probably, you can understand why there's a bit of a buddy-buddy relationship that blooms pretty quickly between him and Bond. And then you do get René Mathis, who's maybe not as colorful as Felix Leiter, but he seems to be a pretty swell guy, too. He comes into Bond's hotel room pretending to be someone installing a radio.
Yes.
I believe. Oui, bonjour, monsieur. I'm here to install your radio. And there's some sort of an opera happening from Rome, I think. And, you know, there's a little bit of...
I've got so much detail on that particular radio and the show that he listens to is actually a show that aired until the 1980s.
1980s?
Yeah.
Really?
Apparently it was something that was on all the time, and it lasted until the 80s. The radio thing kind of baffled me. I'm like, that's his cover? He's a radio installer?
Well, you know, it does sound kind of corny looking back, but then you think of it, there are, what were they called? The Muntzes? The Muntz couple?
Yeah.
Just in the room above, I believe. And I think the idea behind that is to interfere with their frequency. So, you know, you can sort of, it's a little corny. But strategically, for spies, I guess it makes sense, you know.
It's unexpected. Knowing the books, that character comes back multiple times. And the novel, he feels more like he's a contemporary of Bond. He's about the same age. They've known each other because of a previous mission.
Yes, that's true. That's mentioned early in the book, I think. The early part of the book is actually kind of interesting. It starts at Casino Royale. Bond is sort of... he hasn't started competing with Le Chiffre, but he's about to in a day or two, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Then it goes backwards to when he... Actually, it doesn't even go backwards just yet to when he got the mission. It goes back in time to when M is briefed about what might be the mission, and then Bond is briefed on the mission.
Yeah.
That's an interesting way to... certainly, you know, for a series that... You know, this is the first book, so there's no template yet. It's a bit of a artsy way of doing it, I guess. Yeah. So it's like, let's go back in time. And I do like... You don't see M all... We don't see him that much in any of the books, but I do like him in here, where he's reading the description of what another department, you know, their description of what this mission might be, and what's the pronixisme or something like that. He doesn't, what the hell is this word? And,
oh yeah, when
just write it in bloody English, please. You know, so you do get a little bit of that grumpiness, that classic M grumpiness. It's already there near the start. We don't see Moneypenny, do we?
She's mentioned briefly, right. But she's not a character. She's just a name.
Right. She likes Bill Tanner, I think, because... Didn't she say she liked Bill Tanner? Is it? He's a swell fellow. You know, she likes it when he swings by and goes into M's office or something like that, you know?
I don't have much about Bill Tanner.
We've dabbled in plot and character a lot, but I think one of the things we're trying to accomplish through this podcast series is also maybe understanding the background of the book and maybe what influenced Ian Fleming himself. So I say we, but maybe this week, you.
You mean me?
Yeah, I definitely mean you. We strive to do a little bit of research, maybe just understand the socio, you know, geopolitical and cultural context in which the books are written. Now, I did some reading, but clearly you came much better equipped than myself. I have some ideas of what influenced the book, like the Cambridge Files and the Cambridge Spies.
Yeah.
But you were talking about a lot of stuff before we started recording.
I did. First off, there are two things I think could define the year 1953. One of the first, probably the most important thing, is the death of Stalin in March of 1953. That created a power vacuum, and that more or less ignited even more the Cold War, I feel. Like, it seems like it had an impact on the Cold War itself.
Well, I mean, Stalin had he ruled with an iron fist for all intents and purposes, so that maybe took the USSR in a slightly different direction, and one that, I guess no pun intended, but the Cold War heated up following his passing, because Stalin had been an ally not too long ago in World War II, although it wasn't like, you're a great guy, let's work together. It was more like, well, the Nazis are worse, so we're going to work with you.
The enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Precisely, but in this case, it really felt like that. Possibly.
Yes.
Well, I mean, speaking of the Cold War, I mean, the fact of the matter is, you know, the villain in this book and in the next two or three books is the Soviet Union. I mean, Le Chiffre is an agent of the USSR. I mean, Smersh, the assassination group. So certainly the Cold War is looming over Europe and the United States at this time. So that obviously has a huge influence on why Ian Fleming chose to include that pretty massively in the book.
On June 19th, 53. I was looking for the year. I'm like, you're talking about 1953, Matt. It's just 1953. Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. I don't know a lot about him. I've heard about him when the spy stuff is mentioned. But there were a couple that were caught spying for the USSR. And that's how allegedly, the Russians were able to get nuclear secrets because they passed them from. And they were executed on June 19th. And I think Truman announced that the USA had hydrogen bomb on January 7th, and I think by the end of the summer, or before the end of the year, USSR also admitted that they had the hydrogen bomb. So there was a fight or a competition to who's going to get the bomb. Are you going to get the bomb? I'm going to get the bomb.
There you go.
Also, it's the end of the Korean War, which doesn't play in the Bond novels, but plays in the Bond movies.
It does, but again, it's still a product of the Cold War for all intents and purposes. I mean, we won't get into the history of the Cold War, the history of the Korean War, but certainly the Korean War is in large part influenced by
what the
Western masters, so to speak, are doing. And it's interesting that you brought up the two agents that were caught spying for the USSR and getting secrets about the hydrogen bomb, because Vesper Lynn turns out to be a double agent herself.
Yes, so she does.
That made headlines. It was a big controversy, or as the English would say, controversy. I feel as though that probably, to an extent, influenced Fleming in creating this character of Vesper Lynn, who seems to be a good little girl, and until we find out that no, she was actually playing Bond all this time. So it's sort of like the butler did it. You know, it's the person you least expect that committed the murder. Well, the person you least expect to have maybe given away Bond's secrets to the Chiffre and Smirsch, well, it turns out to be her. The very woman, the very person he was going to ask her hand in marriage, just as their relationship starts to deteriorate, I think, on the very day. So double agents, Cold War, certainly that plays a large part in what makes up Casino Royale, the book.
And also I have a few notable births. Author Sebastian Fox was born.
That's a name that might come up in many episodes from now, but yes, I know who that is. Yeah.
He wrote, I think it's Devil May Care.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I haven't read that one. A little known actor, you probably heard about him. It's Pierce Brosnan, was born on May 16th.
Rings a distant bell.
Yeah, that's, might have played the part. Also, I have an actress here. It's a little bit more distant, but Kim Basinger was born on December 8th. Oh, very important detail regarding Bond. Hugh Hefner started publication of the Playboy magazine in 1953 December.
Really?
Yes, he did.
And surprisingly, or perhaps not surprisingly, Playboy did play something of a role in increasing Bond's popularity.
Yes, it did. Yeah. Fleming published a few short stories.
Mm.
And Pages magazine was even featured in On Her Majesty's Secret Service.
One of my favorite scenes, actually. I love that scene. I've heard that Hugh Hefner was also a big fan of the films as well. Did he have like private screenings at his Bunny Palace or whatever it's supposed to be called?
Playboy Mansion.
I'm gonna go with Bunny Palace. I like that.
I love the Bunny Palace.
So, yeah, and they would play the Bond film sometimes. Pierce Brosnan,
1953. Mm-hmm.
There, wow. Jeez.
Well, Kim Basinger, Domino in Never Seen It, Never Again.
Absolutely. We salute you, Kim Basinger. That's, I salute you.
I salute you.
Oh, yes.
If not for that, for Batman.
That's true. She's Vicky Vale. I was about to start describing one of my favorite Batman scenes, but this is a Bond, James Bond podcast. We wanted to maybe broach like leftovers, maybe what didn't make.
Oh, I have notes on that too.
Do you really?
I do.
I defer to you, sir. I'm Bond. You're M. You know more than I do. So,
okay.
You know, elements from the novel not used in the movies.
I'll admit there's not much.
There's a lot in the movie that's not in the book, but we'll get that in the next episode.
Exactly.
But there's some stuff from the books.
Some stuff which you need to, you would need to change it, but there's little notions in the books that amused me. The Munces, for example.
Mm.
just the idea of a little couple, maybe a middle-aged couple, maybe I'm thinking Winton Kid.
Yeah, I didn't think of that, but that's a pretty good, that's a pretty interesting. We don't see the Munces, but by the way they're described, they sort of fit that mold a little bit.
A little couple, you think they're either a middle-aged couple that always fighting, they're past their prime, or very much older, and they're like more like grandfatherly. And you could have them as henchmen and as hench people. I could see them working as hench people. They amused me. There's two assassination attempts on Bond, and none of them made it in the movie.
Well, they're both spectacular in their own rights, but I love the first one with these two Georgian assassins. Yes. And how does it go? Each one is holding a box.
Yes.
They are under the impression that one of them has a box that will just release some smoke, I think, and the other one is the explosive, but in actuality
they're both bombs.
Speaking of double agents, they've been crossed, so you know, kill Bond, and by the way, we'll kill them as well, just to like clear our traces.
It's funny because it's the first attempt on Bond's life in any media.
Yeah, and it's great, and I love the way I sound like a broken record, Leon Fleming's descriptions. I love the way he describes Bond being like thrown back, and his chest is all hot because there's so much fire. And as he's coming out of it, he's coming around. There are pieces of flesh all around. And he's about to vomit, actually. He's about to vomit.
He's on the verge of throwing up.
The film Bond would never throw up.
It would just go.
Bond is a little bit repulsed by what he's seen on the street.
That's the thing. Yeah. That's also one thing. That the novel version of the Bond character is much disgusted by violence and gruesomeness.
Yeah.
It affects him, while in the movie, it's never shown to have an effect on him.
Yeah, or barely. Yeah, very rarely, actually. The other attempt on his life, which is during the Baccarat game. Now, there are attempts on his life in the film, so they sort of took that idea and applied it to the film, but not that assassination attempt.
But that particular one that you mentioned, I don't know if it would play in a film version. I see the first one, it could have worked, but it would have been too much ridiculous in the film version, I think.
Well, I think they tried it. That's how Kananga dies in Live and Let Die.
Yeah. But the second one, it's great to read because there's a lot of the.
And he's very worried. Like that doesn't don't like Vesper and Felix. Can't they see me? Can't they see him in trouble? But no, they can't, buddy. You're on your own. You got to think of something.
It would have lasted like a quarter of a second in film version. So I see it. It's not very cinematic.
It ends in kind of a fun, like he. Pushes himself away from the table. I'm moving from the mic. He pushes away from the table, which means the it's a cane which is actually a gun, and because of the pressure of the chair swiftly falling to the ground, while the assassin behind Bond loses grip of the cane himself, and it reads kind of funny actually. Which is I like the description. The first assassination attempt, we hear about it after Bond has left the table where Mathis and Vesper are, and their chairs are sort of like blown back. Every time I read that description, I just see like two almost like cartoon characters, like whoop, like they're just blown away by the wind. Yeah, maybe it would not have played out that well on film.
I see why they did what they did in the movie. But the Munces, that's something they could bring back as hench people. Yeah.
Babs, McGee, if you're listening. Hey, who's writing this thing? Neil Purvis and Robert Wade and Neil Purvis?
Yeah.
If you guys are listening.
The Munces, the movie.
Bond 25, maybe they get Blofeld out of prison.
Well, why not? But
why not?
The thing is that there's such a pair of little characters that they don't even get a physical description. You can do whatever you want with them.
Absolutely.
But the idea of a little old couple being a threat to James Bond, it's amusing to me. It's a little bit like Winton Kid. There's something about amusing about it. So
there's something else that actually just came to me. One of the biggest moments in the film is the extremely brief car pursuit, which sees Bond's car flip over. It's something very different in the book that makes his car flip over. It's kind of cool, actually. I kind of like it.
In both movies, in both the movie and the book, I think he's drunk. That's always been my theory about the.
I'm sure he is, but still, the spikes on the road probably didn't help.
No, it didn't. I love the film version, but we'll discuss it when we get there.
I know. We got to stop. We apologize profusely, listeners. I'm sure you can tell that we're big fans of the film. We'll get to it next episode. Stay tuned, but still. I like the fact that in the book, for a very brief stint, Fleming actually takes us to Le Chiffre's car. Like, we're suddenly in his car describing the action, and then we get back to Bond after his tires have exploded.
Now that you say that, it makes me realize that there's a description of Vesper in that part of the novel where she's just a pair of legs and her dress is tied over her head. To me, that sums up that character. That's what she is.
I think he uses a trust chicken, I think, is the terms he uses twice. I think even Bond says that. You look like a trust chicken. So harsh, Matthew.
I'm a big fan of the cinematic interpretation. It's just I don't think that character is fleshed out very well in the novel. I don't think anyone could argue that she's a very well-defined character.
Yeah, it's one of those things where you read the book and unfortunately for Bond, their relationship begins to disintegrate on the day he has decided to ask her hand in marriage. And I'm reading it going, so she's the one he wants to marry. What the heck were the previous women in his life like, if that's the one he wants to marry? Again, if you've seen the film, you know, it's one of those weird things where, despite Ian Fleming's great descriptions, I'll still sometimes see the evergreen in my head when I'm reading the book. But I have to remind myself that it's not that version of the character. It is this somewhat plain version. I'm just always surprised when he's on that beach near the end of the book before things go awry. He's on that beach. He gets up. Oh, today's the day I'm going to marry. I'm like, where did this come from? You just screwed up a couple times and that's it. Like, where's this coming from?
You know, there's a thing sometimes in movies where you have two characters that get thrown into an action movie, like Towering Inferno. I think there's a janitor that falls in love with a rich heiress or something. And of course, going to stay together. And you follow, if you were to make a sequel 2 days later, of course, they don't have anything to come. And they were just put in a very intense situation. And they did what they had to do. And it's the end of it.
Towering Inferno, you might say the passions ignited.
Wow, you're really good at this, aren't you?
I thank you, Sir Roger Moore.
Barbara?
Yes, you need some quips. I have rest in peace, Sir Roger Moore, to thank for that. I think I've seen the Moore films a few too many times. Anytime you talked up low seven, I get into quip mode. But thank you for the compliment.
It's good. Good one.
Was there anything else about what didn't make it into the book? I got to admit, I'm sort of empty right here. Did you have anything else?
Anything worth?
Right, exactly. Not like little details like, oh, it's Baccarat and not poker, you know.
No. Anything worth recycling or recuperating? There's probably brief descriptions of stuff, but
Herr Gettler, who's actually described in the book, like, we don't even, I think technically in the credits of Christina Rao, it's Gettler, but you don't really know it. Whereas the book, it actually is a man named Gettler who has an eye patch. You know?
Oh, I have something. They would have to change stuff. But the scarring of his hand.
Shoot.
That's something I completely forgot. I just remember. But it's something they didn't put in the movie for obvious reasons.
It's not Smursh.
It's not Smursh. But he could have.
But it could have been Spectre. Could have been a little octopus.
They could have. After Le Chiffre gets murdered by a Russian agent, that Russian agent scars him with the first word for.
Yeah, it's like an upside down W, which I think is supposed to be sh. Yeah, in the Russian language, Shmiet Shpionim.
And it's meant to let other agents that might face him, to let them know that they're facing a secret agent, because they said, if I play poker, but Baccarat with one of my colleagues, they'll know.
Which is stupid, because doesn't he just get plastic surgery to cover that?
Yeah, but I guess plastic surgery in 1953, it's not like.
Yeah, the Russians didn't know what that existed. The British, England, that's where it's at. You need to get a facelift, or if you need to prevent people from knowing that Smursh knows about you.
Body doubles also.
Body doubles? Absolutely. No, they really knew what they were doing back then. Not like today. It's just the good old days.
So that's one thing. But I don't see them recycling that part of the novel.
Cool, though.
it'd be cool, but without the torture that he's been through before, the scarring becomes pointless. Like, I can't see them. I can't see Bond being tied to a chair and like, I'm going to torture you, Mr. Bond. And, okay, I just did an octopus on your hand. tattoo.
Exactly. I was thinking the same thing. The tattoos really hurt, apparently.
Yeah, there's a notion there. There's something.
I'm surprised they never actually went for that. I guess the closest we get is when Roger Moore puts a third nipple on him to impersonate Scaramouche. You found me rather titillating. You know, that's as close as we get in the books, folks. That is the
tattoo, the scarring of Bond.
That's the movie version of the Casino Royale scar.
What can we tell people about the next novel where Bond goes, maybe? A
little sneak peek. Well, Bond goes to New York for a while, anyways. Yeah. The next book is Live and Let Die.
Yes. So I think we're going to wrap things up.
You can reach us at thejamesbondcomplex.com. I'm at Twitter at @OH_pop. In other words, OOPOP. Matt?
I'm at Matt O'Clair on Twitter.
James Bond will return in Casino Royale 2006.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.